walk across the courtyard towards the library.
Hello and welcome to the July 2017 episode of Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales, brought to you by the Kodiak Public Library Association. This month on Dog-Eared Reads, we have several book reviews from board members of KPLA. Both Athenia and Jan Chatto offer some interesting perspectives on what they've been reading in our Community Roar section. A new segment on our show called Author Spotlight, Matt Freeman profiles the author of the Joe Ledger series named John Mayberry. We also have a heads up on what's going on this month at the Kodiak Public Library, as well as a tech tip about Alaska's Lip Site. There's an interview with the returning board member, Aaron Ellsworth, and James Rains interviews Allison Williford in our Beyond the Cover series. Thanks for tuning in. July is a busy time at the Kodiak Public Library. Bob Ross has started two drawing classes. One's a repeat of his Drawing for Shy People, which runs 10 weeks on Thursdays from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Sign up at the main desk and pay a $5 supply fee to KPLA by cash or check. This informal class is perfect for the shy, artistic novice who wants practical tips and quiet practice time for creating basic sketches of Kodiak events and people. Bob Ross is also offering an intermediate pastel drawing class that runs for 5 weeks that started Wednesday, July 5th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Again, it's not too late to sign up for this, and the supply fee for this one is $15. This advanced class will run through August 9th. Go beyond Drawing for Shy People and enliven your sketches with color and texture. Special this month of July will be papermaking on July 18th from 2 to 3 p.m. with Ellie. The Graphic Novel Book Club will be meeting on July 29th at 4 o'clock p.m. at the Kodiak Brewery. On July 31st, we have a special treat in Kodiak. Emily Ruskovich, author of Idaho, will be coming to the Kodiak Public Library for their Author Speak series, an evening of stories and a chance to hear this author talk about her craft. It is Ruskovich's first novel, and Idaho has met with critical success. Idaho has been described as a character-driven tale that is haunting, moving, reflective, with a compelling writing style that is lyrical, richly detailed, and stylistically complex. Considered a breakthrough book of 2017 by BookBub, this, quote, stunning debut novel about love and forgiveness, about the violence of memory, and equal violence of its loss. From O. Henry Prize-winning author Emily Ruskovich. To summarize the story, Anne and Wade have carved out a life for themselves from a rugged landscape in northern Idaho where they are bound together by more than love. With her husband's memory fading, Anne attempts to piece together the truth of what happened to his first wife, Jenny, and to their daughters. In a story written in exquisite prose and told from multiple perspectives, including Anne, Wade, and Jenny, who's now in prison, we gradually learn of the mysterious and shocking act that fractured Wade and Jenny's lives, and of the love and compassion that brought Anne and Wade together, and of the memories that reverberate throughout the lives of every character in Idaho. In a wild emotional and physical landscape, Wade's past becomes the center of Anne's imagination as Anne becomes determined to understand the family she never knew and to take responsibility for them, reassembling their lives and her own. Copies of this book are available for checkout now at the Kodiak Public Library, and to learn more about Ms. Ruskovich and her work as a writer and to hear some readings from her book, Idaho, come to the Kodiak Public Library Monday, July 31st at 6:30 p.m. Copies of her book will be available for sale and for signing. I hope you'll check it out. This past spring, Kodiak Public Library Association held its annual meeting where it had an election, and at that election, Aaron Ellsworth joined the board. Erin stopped by the studio today so I could interview her for this show. Welcome, Erin. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Lori. I was on the KPLA board previously and during the Capitol campaign when we were building the new library. And then in 2012, I had my first kid, my daughter, Annika. So took a little break from the board. Now I'm back on and I have two kids now and thought it would be a good time to join again.
Well, we're glad to have you. How long have you lived in Kodiak?
Gosh, I've been coming here since about 2000. My husband and I have a SetNet site on the west side in Uganic. And then I moved here full-time in 2008 when I took a job with Fish and Game.
Oh, very nice. You told me that you'd been on the board before, and what drew you back to the board after your hiatus of having two children?
So when I had my second son last November, I left my job, and so I have a little bit more time on my hands. And then, of course, we have this beautiful new library, and I thought it would be fun to be involved again.
Oh, that's great. Tell us a little bit about your interests and maybe other activities in the community that you're involved with.
Well, I've got my two kids that keep me busy hiking and on the beaches. We got a dog, a one-year-old lab, when my son was 2 months old, which... as I would highly recommend to everyone. And so she keeps us on our toes too. And then I just actually sort of out of the blue got another job about a month ago working with the Kodiak Salmon Work Group.
Oh, congratulations. Are there any projects or things that are going on with KPLA in which you hope to get involved?
My interest in rejoining KPLA, aside from the normal things that are going on with the organization, is that I'm hoping to bring maybe a little more energy to the family and youth activity side of things there, sort of reaching out to the community and seeing the interests and needs are and how KPLA could help address those.
Well, that sounds good. If you were to meet a visitor at the public library, what would you share with them or what would you tell them is your favorite place or resource at our new library?
Well, in my non-existent free time, I would love to take a book and sit by the fireplace. That's a wonderful spot over there. Yeah, that's probably my favorite spot in the library.
Oh, well, that's great. Yes, so we have some beautiful artwork and we welcome the visitors when they come on the cruise ship, and we have a group of volunteers for KPLA who help out with that. And I know that many of them have been impressed with the special spaces that when you were on the board, you helped create. And so thank you very much for your service. And we're really glad to have you back.
Thanks, Lori.
You're welcome. In our community roar or raving over amazing reads, Jan Chatto reviews a book about surfing. Give a listen.
My name's Jan Chatto, and many of you know me. I love books. And I was doing something the other day, which many of you have done. I'm just surfing the web looking for a new book to either buy or get from my library. And I saw a book called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan. And my husband was an avid surfer, so I thought, well, maybe this will be interesting. Then I noticed it won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for autobiography, which surprised me because often surf articles are more like, hey dude, the wave was rad, and that's about all you get. But with this book, there was a lot more. The Pulitzer Prize Board said that it was an old school adventure story and intellectual autobiography, a social history, a literary road movie, and an extraordinary exploration of the gradual mastering of an exacting, little understood art, which I thought said a lot. So it's the story of Bill Finnegan's life, but it's also a study in why we can become obsessed with something in our lives, which in this case was surfing. I could relate to this tale because my own husband had been bitten by the surfing bug when he was a young boy also. I was witness to his endless fascination with surfing and wanted to understand it a bit more. However, this book is far more than just a book about surfing. Finnegan is a brilliant writer and reporter who has written for The New Yorker and Outside magazines. I particularly enjoyed the characters he so vividly recalls. Let's face it, extreme sports attract eccentric people, and he brings them to life. Fishermen can probably relate to Finnegan's endless fascination with the ocean and the weather. However, the details of the sport do not drag the reader into a rabbit warren of details. They seem essential to the tale. They remind me of the technical details found in Daniel Brown's Boys in the Boat, the true story of a rowing team. I enjoyed that book also, even though there were a lot of details about rowing and building boats. This memoir is a coming-of-age memoir to begin with. He was a Haole boy suddenly transplanted to Hawaii. And for any of you who don't know, Haole means little white kid. So he was definitely the outsider. He says, "Matters weren't helped by the fact that to my classmates, I seemed not to exist socially." I'm sure some of us can relate to that. I was the new kid in a high school myself. For my husband, it was a disfiguring accident that sent him into social limbo. The surfing crowd didn't care what his face looked like. The love of the sport and the ocean was their bond. This book dives deeply into the inner motivation for our passions. Finnegan says memoir is a weird genre for a reporter. You end up investigating your own private life to be super self-centered, which is the opposite of reporting. He kept journals in his youth, which were helpful, although he says they were not so much full of facts as they were obtuse and abstract. The impetus to begin the book, which had been floating around in his head for years, came from letters that he had written to a friend some 40 years ago, which were returned to him by that friend's mother. I wonder if any of us will have words of our youth preserved like that. In an interview, he states, "I try to ease people into the water, keep them oriented, introduce the terms of the art without dumbing things down. Give readers a stake in every surf scene, not necessarily through action, but through characters. Core surfers rightly snort at every crossover effort to depict their world. Credibility and authenticity just seem to vanish. We can all recall the Gidget movies. This book brings that world vividly to life. I traveled all over the world with Finnegan and his weird buddies as he sought the perfect wave." One of the conflicts of the book is, how do you continue a passion like this and still be the grown-up with a family and the big boy job? Should you continue your passion, or should you just let it go? And that conflict plays through the book as he tries to decide and then jumps for that next wave. I found the book fascinating and a really good read, so I would recommend it to anybody, even if you're not a particular surfing fan. The name of the book, again, is Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan.
Thank you, Jan. That sounds like a really good summer read. If you've just joined us, this is Dog-Eared Reads, and we are in the middle of our community roars, where local people read their book reviews. Coming up, we have Athenia Large reviewing a new book that she's just read called Sapiens.
Hi, this is Athenia Large, and I want to talk to you about one of the best books I've read in the last couple of years. This book is by Yuval Noah Harari, and it's called Sapiens. Now, I'm going to preface this by saying that I'm actually not the kind of person that's an avid reader of historical books. I've read a couple of them, but it's not really my thing. Sociological books, the same thing. I've taken a sociology class, so I've had to read a few of them, but it's not something I actually pick up for enjoyment very often. This book I did because there's a lot of buzz about it. My friends were talking about it and buying copies to keep. I was seeing the really high ratings that Goodreads had about it, so I thought, I've got to check this book out. There's too much buzz. So I checked it out from the Kodiak Public Library. They have both the digital version in audiobook and the regular book print copy, which is quite heavy. I got the audio version first and ended up with the print copy afterwards because it takes a while to read. It comes in at just under 500 pages and it's still quite a lot. The cover of the book says it's a brief history of humankind, and it is, because in order to cover 70,000 years of history, you have to be very brief, but brief is still 500 pages. It took a while. So I finished the book by reading it. I started it on audio, and I was really impressed with how much I liked this book in particular on audio, and here's why. He is telling an amazing story. He's telling it well, and he's pacing it so perfectly that you can always stay interested. It's moving like a train, and you want to be right there with it. I was able to putter around my house and do tasks and never get distracted. I always wanted to hear every word that was coming next, especially in the first half of this book. By the time I got to the second half of the book, it wasn't quite as exciting for me, so I was happier reading it where I could still absorb all the information without having to really stay focused on listening. It was really the first half of this book that kept me on the edge of my seat. The first half of the book is where he really explores why 70,000 years ago there was maybe 6 different species of humans on Earth, and why now there's only one, and what separated, differentiated us, and eventually led to the dominance of Homo sapiens and the disappearance of all those other humans. So we know that part of this evolution is the use of tools, right? But there are other species that use tools. We know that working together in a community is a part of that, but there are other species that work together. There are other apes that work together. So what sets us apart? And it was really fascinating to me that what sets us apart is what he calls the cognitive revolution, is when we learn to go from just small approximately 150 community-sized groups working together to larger multiple hundreds, multiple thousands working together. So as a species, as a group, we can expand our knowledge infinitely instead of just passing our knowledge on one-to-one, generation to generation. Now even we have the ability to store and share our information worldwide and instantaneously. It's mind-boggling, and in his last chapter, he touches on what that could potentially mean for our future. It was fascinating to me that he talked about how gossip is actually really important for the evolution of mankind, because the ability to talk about your neighbor, talk about what's good, and also to talk about what's bad, maybe talk about the neighbor that you can't trust, and to pass that information along gives you, in a community, the ability to trust more people than those people that you personally know intimately. Fascinating, I'll tell you. There were so many times that I read a fact and I was just like, this is amazing, I can't believe I didn't know this, or something that I read and knew, but he said it in a different way that just gave me a different perspective, a more of a bird's eye, big picture view that just changed my worldview, you know, instantly. Honestly, I think I've brought this book up almost every single day since I was about 100 pages into it. We'll be talking about economics, I'll bring this book up. We'll be talking about biology, I'll bring this book up. We'll be talking about technology and the future of computers, I'll bring this book up. This book is amazing. It covers all these different perspectives and puts them together in a way that's out of the box thinking. I was really impressed with this. So here's an example. The idea that human rights are actually not a right at all. They are a fiction that we all choose to believe in, like we choose to believe in a religion or in money or in nationality, like being an American. And you might think, oh yeah, I knew that already, Athenia. And maybe you did. So I still would challenge those people to read this book and see if there is another moment in the book, or maybe a way that he takes that information that you do already know and blows your mind with it the way that he did mine. Because for me, if we were talking and you told me that, I would probably say that too. Yeah, I already know that. But reading the book and the way that he explained how similar that is to the belief in currency or the belief in religion or the belief in nationalism, and how all of that is so intricately tied in with our evolution, how so many of these things in our life, like war, all the conflicts and fights over these ideologies and fictions, religion, economics, human rights, nationalism, but they are also inextricably linked to our evolution, and the fact that we are the dominant species is predicated on the fact that we can believe in these fictional things. Amazing. It actually gave me a lot of peace to reconcile the fact that some of the worst atrocities committed by our humankind are because of our belief in these fictions that are so important to us as a species. And these fictions are also responsible for some of the most beautiful things that we've created, art, or the potential we have to create fictions or ideologies that will help support and improve the world in the future. The fact that we can choose what we do once we have the knowledge of how important these fictions are. So the book talks about the agricultural revolution we went through, for better or for worse, the technological revolution we went through. It talks about the rise and fall of empires, why they rose, why they fell, the rise and fall of religion, and how as capitalism rose, religion fell. He delves into economics, explains capitalism a little bit and why it's dependent on continual growth and why that may or may not be sustainable or may not be beneficial to the individual or may not be beneficial to the species, and how those things can be very separate things. How we might be evolving to the betterment of our species, but to the detriment of every individual's personal happiness in life. How we've done that to animals that we've domesticated. Oh, I'm getting caught up again. I could talk about this book for hours. I could talk about almost every chapter of this book. I could talk about for an entire evening with my friends. This book is so meaty and juicy and great for book clubs, or great for if you want, you know, something that pushes the boundaries of your mind a little bit, or if you're already the kind of person that likes Jared Diamond or those kind of historical sociological overview books, you're gonna love this. I love this. I hope you all will love this as much as I did and check it out. I will come back in the future and do another book review of his second book that I'm reading right now called Homo Du. But until then, please go and check out Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. It's available at the Kodiak Public Library. I'm Athenia, and I'd like to wish you a lovely month of happy reading.
Thanks, Athenia. That sounds like an interesting book, and I'm glad you're reading the second one. Well, coming up here on Dog-Eared Reads, we have a new item on our show called Author Showcase, a chance to focus on a single author each month. Matt Freeman provides us with an interesting look at Jonathan Mayberry, who writes horror fiction as well as zombie books. Let's hear what Matt has to share with us in our section called Author Spotlight.
Hi, I'm Matt Freeman for Dog-Eared Reads, and this month I would like to talk to you about zombies. Now, you may ask yourself, does this qualify as light summer reading? And the answer is, yes, absolutely. It does for me. But let me back up a second. Last month, I did an author showcase on Lee Child, the creator of this very successful action-adventure thriller series starring Jack Reacher. Jack Reacher, a former investigator for the MPs in the Army, he's smart, observant, excellent shot, and can kick your butt with very little effort. So, what if you took a character like that and dropped him into the world of The Walking Dead? His smarts, his marksmanship would, I think, make him more likely to survive in a zombie apocalypse. He might even freak out a little bit, and that would be interesting because Jack Reacher never freaks out. But I suppose he could adjust quickly and start taking down zombies the way he takes down regular bad guys. So, for this edition of Dog-Eared Reads, I wanted to talk about one of my favorite living authors, Jonathan Mayberry. And although Mayberry is one of the most prolific authors today, he's still rather unappreciated. He's one of the best authors you never heard of. Never mind that his first novel, Patient Zero, earned a Stoker Award for Best First Novel. And aside from the fact that he's written fantasy horror, scientific horror, young adult horror, and even Marvel Comics horror, he seems to be an author that few have even heard about, and that's horrible. I'm going to tell you about two different series that Mayberry's working on currently. One of them for grown-ups, and the other for young adults. And I'm going to tell you why they're great and why you should check them out. First, the Joe Ledger series, Patient Zero, The Dragon Factory, The King of Plagues, Assassin's Code, Extinction Machine, Code Zero, Predator One, Kill Switch, Dogs of War. Those titles give you the clues. These stories are about life and death, very violent death. I don't think many of Jonathan Mayberry's characters die peacefully in their sleep. All these stories deal with potentially world-ending crises, and they mostly involve brilliantly fiendish bad guys who, out of greed or lust for power or fanatical belief in a cause, they pretty much want to kill off most of the population of the planet Earth. And Joe Ledger, a Baltimore cop with excellent reflexes, becomes the Jack Bauer in a world beset by terrorism of all kinds, terrorists who use cutting-edge technologies to come up with ever more creative ways to wipe us out. Okay, that might sound a little out there, but Mayberry does a good job of grounding things fairly well, or at least believably, in science and in realism. The human reactions are authentic, and so are the fight scenes. One of Mayberry's strengths is that he has trained in the martial arts since he was a kid, and he has a black belt in jiu-jitsu, so when he writes a fight scene, it sounds like it's written by someone who knows what he's talking about. Now, side note, most authors are not fighters. Quite frequently, authors, when they were kids, were daydreamers in school, nerds, people who doodled in the margins of their notebooks, made a lot of trips to the library, you know, that kind of person. So, when that kind of author writes a fight scene, they're not usually talking from personal experience. And that's okay. That's why authors have imaginations. I'm sure Stephen King doesn't often really write from personal experience. When you have an author that can take a person down, that's exciting. Jonathan Mayberry was interviewed for Nightmare Magazine in 2013. Here's how he described his writing and use of martial arts. He said, "I'm a fight scene snob. You can kill my interest in something really quickly with a bad fight scene. For example, the movie Taken with Liam Neeson, the first two-thirds of it, the fight choreography is brilliant. It's exactly the way a tall, middle-aged man would fight, because a tall, middle-aged man would fight differently than a tall young man. Then he starts dodging machine gun bullets, and it all falls apart. I've had 48 years in jiu-jitsu and kenjutsu. I was a bodyguard, I was a bouncer, I was a martial arts instructor. I created self-defense programs for women, for the visually impaired, for the physically challenged, for kids. I was the Philadelphia DA's office expert witness for murder cases involving martial arts. And I also ran a company called CopSafe, which taught arrest and control workshops to all levels of law enforcement, including SWAT. Jiu-jitsu is all about physics. Physics will overcome brawn every time. So I draw all that in there. Everything that Joe Ledger does is possible. And a lot of that I have done, although I've never killed anyone. I have dented a few people. I also have quite a few friends in SWAT and in Special Forces. And after I write an action scene, they usually vet it for me. Any technical errors that show up in gunplay are mine, because I'm just not an experienced handgun expert. When I was a bodyguard, I carried a revolver and never pulled it. So there may be a few little technical errors there, but the hand-to-hand stuff, that's all real. That was author Jonathan Mayberry describing how he's used his own experience in martial arts to give his action thriller horror novels a unique and grounded perspective. Here's a sample of an action scene involving Joe Ledger. This is probably the only time that he's actually defeated in hand-to-hand combat. This is taken from the short story Artifact in the collection Joe Ledger Special Ops. He's fighting an unknown assailant dressed in black from head to toe, black balaclava and black goggles. Can't tell anything about him except he's there suddenly in a place that he couldn't possibly be. So he shoots him. And here's the excerpt. In the script in my head that I was writing for this scene, he should have folded up like a deck chair, and that should have been that. That wasn't how it played out. I fired the dart gun, and he moved out of the line of fire. It was weird. I mean, he was fast, but not the Flash. It wasn't like he dodged a bullet, so to speak. He wasn't that fast. No, it was like he had such perfect timing that as I fired, he was already moving, as if knowing exactly the timing and angle of my shot. Then he pivoted and slapped the gun out of my hand. There's a way to do that if you know what you're doing. You hit the gun at one angle and the back of the wrist at another. Do it fast and simultaneously, and the gun goes flying. My gun went flying. I have been disarmed exactly once in my adult life. That time. If anyone had wanted to wager on whether someone could do that to me, I would have bet my whole pension on that answer being no. My gun went flying anyway. I wasted no time goggling at it. I kicked him in the knee, which he blocked with a raised leg hoof kick. I hooked a left at his short ribs, but he chop blocked with his elbow and counter punched me in the biceps, numbing my arm. Growling in pain and anger, I faked once, twice, and hit him with a jab in the nose. Except that he turned his head 2 inches to the left so that my jab hit the point of his cheekbone. Then he switched from defense to offense, throwing a series of punches and kicks at me that hammered me all the way across the hall and against the wall. He blocked every one of my counterpunches, parried every kick, even intruded into my attempted headbutt by headbutting me. It was all very fast and very painful. I won't lie, and I won't sugarcoat it. He beat the crap out of me. He humiliated me. I didn't land a single solid punch on him, and he hit me as often as he wanted to, and it was pretty clear that he really wanted to. Winded, bleeding, bruised, and dazed, I sagged against the wall. I tried to win that fight. I've never really lost a fight, not in years. Not any fight that's ever mattered to me. No matter how tough the other guy was, I was tougher. Or if he was too tough, then I won because I was crazier. I don't care if I get hurt, but I will win a fight. I'll burn down a house if that's what it takes to win a fight. Except that I lost this fight. Lost it fast and lost it completely. This man, whoever he was, outfought me. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, cool, good fight scene. Yeah, but what about the zombies? Okay, I just need to clarify that the Joe Ledger series is not a zombie series per se. Zombies are just one part of it. There are many ways for unrestrained scientific genius to destroy the world, and believe me, Jonathan Mayberry has cooked up a different one in each book. The Joe Ledger books are each partially narrated by Joe Ledger, so you find out that even though he is an extraordinary sort of super soldier spy, kind of half Rambo, half James Bond, he is much more human than those action hero icons. Ledger freaks out. He's horrified by the monsters he must fight. He loves, he grieves, he makes jokes. He's not a machine. He's haunted by an incident from when he was a teenager when thugs beat him down and assaulted his girlfriend, and he couldn't do anything to stop it. That incident broke him inside, but it also remade him into the guy who stops bad people from doing bad stuff. It's a little bit of the Batman story. Now, in the wrong hands, plot lines and characters like these could turn into cheesy parodies, and not everybody likes this series. People who are ravenous for zombie stories can be disappointed that it's not really about zombies. It's about science gone wrong. It's about how scientific research has advanced into some scary territory, and imaginative terrorists could use this technology, the technology currently in development, to do very, very bad things. A weaponized zombie virus is just one idea. Joe's lack of hesitation when faced with deadly, freaky things gets him noticed by the Department of Military Sciences, a secretive branch of national security headed by the secretive, emotionless Mr. Church. Actually, he's not entirely emotionless, but you have to look really carefully. He has a lot of self-control, and he has the best technology available. Actually, he has the best technology that's not available, not to you. He has a computer program called Mind Reader that can hack into any database and then erase its tracks so the person doesn't even know they've been hacked. Plus, he's got an arsenal of guns and body armor and choppers. They're very well funded. So, zombies? Yes. But you'd be amazed at how many different ways there are to end the world with science. In one book, there's a race of genetic deviants who have been carrying on a breeding program for generations, perfecting a subspecies of very strong, very fast individuals who are active at night and who love to kill people. I don't know if they drink blood. Can't remember. In another story, in fact, this is the most recent book, Dogs of War, a combination of nanotech and virology, the science of viruses, produces a weaponized form of rabies. It's pretty nasty. The author says he bases everything in this series on science, but he does push the envelope. One adventure has our own military doing gene therapy experiments on volunteer soldiers, creating an out-of-control insect-human hybrid. In last year's release, Killswitch, someone has figured out how to hack the human brain from a distance, turning Joe's own friends and loved ones into merciless killers. And in Dogs of War, the 2017 release, it's robotics. Dog-sized robots with built-in weapons that can be programmed to shoot or just blow up. Other lines of robotics, tiny cockroach-sized mini-bots that can be used for search and rescue to help people, or they can quietly infiltrate and explode. And, of course, you've got your microscopic nanobots that are delivering deadly viruses, too. Mayberry recognizes that technology is a two-edged sword. In the hands of good and responsible people, it can protect the world and its inhabitants. But trouble is, it's so often it gets found in the hands of greedy or fanatical psychopaths. Every year, Jonathan Mayberry comes up with a different way to destroy the world, and you start to wonder how long Joe Ledger and his friends can keep on saving it.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Dog-Eared Reads, section of Author Showcase, in which Matt Freeman is reviewing an author that he likes called Jonathan Mayberry.
In his young adult series, starting with 2010's Rot and Ruin, we enter a world that has lost that battle. Somebody re-engineered a virus and unleashed a global zombie apocalypse, and now, 15 years later, the Zoms are just part of life. For young people like Benny Imura, it's the only life they've known. Survival in a fenced-in community surrounded by hungry, dead people. What's fresh about this series is that the adults who remember life as it was before, who survived the horrors of first night when the zombies first appeared, these adults are all suffering from some level of post-traumatic stress disorder. There's a broken place inside each of them. They've all lost people. They've lost family. They've lost an entire world. For teenagers, though, it's different. This is all that they've ever known. They're used to living with zombies at the gate, and they want more. They're tired of the restrictions and regulations imposed on this community. And Benny is old enough now where he has to find a job or else have his rations cut in half. After trying a number of trades, there's nothing left for him to do but work with his older brother Tom, who, as far as Benny is concerned, is a coward. Benny's earliest memory is of Tom grabbing him and running away, abandoning their mother to the zombies. Part of Benny's growth arc is learning what his brother really does and coming to realize that he had him all wrong. Benny grows up from being a whiny teenage jerk, thank goodness, into someone who has your back when things go bad. It's hard being a teen in a zombie-filled wasteland. Death is everywhere. And even if you die of natural causes, you will rise again as a zombie unless somebody immediately puts a spike through your brain. So, folks have learned to sleep in separate bedrooms and lock their doors, every door, so that if someone passes in the night, they won't roam through the house and kill everybody. Even adolescent romance is tainted by this darkness. Benny has feelings for his childhood friend Nix, who was brutalized by some bad guys, and is maybe not that emotionally available. Benny's best friend Chong has a hopeless crush on a wild, self-taught, zombie-killing girl who's been surviving alone in the woods for years. In this excerpt from 2010's book, Rot and Ruin, the two boys are talking about what else? Girls. Liu Chong wondered if throwing himself off the guard tower would be better than going home. If he jumped over the rail, the worst that could happen would be a crushing impact on the ground, after which he'd be devoured by zombies. You are a total chicken, observed Benny Imura, who was sitting on a wooden crate in the far corner of the tower. Obviously, agreed Chong. What's your point? Benny shook his head. Dude, it's so easy. She lives at your house. You see her every day. All you have to do is say something to her. Really, replied Chong as he folded his arms and leaned against the rail. That's all I have to do. I go up to a girl who is a year older than me, a girl who has lived alone for years doing nothing but killing zombies and rogue bounty hunters, a girl who knows more ways to kill me than I even know how to die, a girl who fought in the zombie pits at Gameland when she was 11. A girl, I might add, who is skilled with every kind of lethal weapon from handguns to swords. You want me to go up to that girl and just ask her to the summer dance? That's what you think is easy? Sure. So, I was right all along. You are brain dead. Hey, I mean, are you trying to get me killed? You have to admit, she's hot. Chong cocked his head to one side. No, I don't think hot is really adequate, do you? And we both know she doesn't have a boyfriend. She's never had a boyfriend, corrected Chong, because she is a feral zombie killer. She's killed everyone who ever tried to get near her. She didn't kill me. Hope springs eternal, murmured Chong. What's the worst that could happen? Demanded Benny. Chong began ticking items off on his fingers. Being beaten viciously about the head and shoulders, comprehensive humiliation, thrusting of sharp objects through my flesh. Benny made loud clucking sounds. Chong stared at him through narrowed eyes. I said I was afraid of Lila, he said evenly. I never said I was afraid of you. In fact, some recreational Benny maiming might take the edge off the day. Ha! I'm a professional zombie hunter now. My body is a weapon. My arms are spears. My legs are swords. He faked a kick at Chong, but the motion knocked Benny off his crate and he crashed down onto the tower floor. Yes, a living weapon, I see, observed Chong dryly. Benny came off the floor and tackled him, and they wrestled from one end of the guard tower to the other, making loud fighting sounds like they had in old comic books. Pow! And crunch! Chong was pretending to bash Benny's head against the fence when the shift supervisor bellowed up at him. What the bloody hell you two monkey bangers doing up there? Do I have to come up and teach you how to act like adults? We're not adults, Benny yelled, but before the words could get out, Chong clamped a hand around his mouth. All that escaped was a muffled nothing. That was an excerpt from the first book in Mayberry's YA series, Rot and Ruin. The library has that, and also Dust and Decay and Flesh and Bone. One fun thing about Jonathan Mayberry's books is that characters from one series may show up in another. In the Joe Ledger series, the person that I would vote for as most likely to survive a zombie apocalypse would be, of course, Joe Ledger. And he actually shows up in the Rot and Ruin series, a grizzled, scarred, surprisingly cheerful Joe Ledger, traveling from place to place, still trying to keep the human race alive after all these years.
Thank you, Matt, for this month's author spotlight on Jonathan Mayberry, author of the Joe Ledger series. You can find many of these books at the Kodiak Public Library. This month's tech tip is about LitSight Alaska, part of the State Library Electronic Doorway, or SLED, found online at sled.alaska.edu. LitSight Alaska is a cool resource for all ages and all things Alaska literature and writing. It's a gathering place for Alaskans of all ages. Here, storytelling is a window to literacy, cultural diversity, and life in Alaska, with special features for educators, students, parents, and health professionals. The LitSight Alaska is divided into several sections like history and culture, family and communities, libraries and bookstores, and more. And each section contains information pertaining to Alaskans. In the reading and writing section, you'll find stories from people who have discovered how reading has enriched their lives, and they are eager to pass it on through traditional and non-traditional ways. Learn from teachers and parents who share their ideas for teaching and instilling a desire to read. Discover contents, community programs, and organizations that promote reading, writing, and the art of storytelling in its many forms. And I really like the interactive timeline of Alaska history called Alaska Stories from Pleistocene to the Present. It offers an opportunity to examine the evolution of Alaska history and the ordinary people whose extraordinary aspirations have made Alaska into what it is today. The site also links to the Alaska Digital Archives and other databases that we have, and it's a useful tool for everything Alaska literacy. Check it out on sled.alaska.edu. Under SLED websites, choose the first one, Arts and Literature, and on that page you'll find LitSight Alaska. I hope you find it as interesting as I do and a place to learn something new about Alaska and its resources and opportunities for growth with literacy. That's our tech tip for this month's Dog-Eared Reads.
The story, From Rumpelstiltskin to War and Peace, is one of the basic tools invented by the human mind for the purpose of gaining understanding. There have been great societies that did not use the wheel, but there have been no societies that did not tell stories. Ursula K. Le Guin.
I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm, bookworm. I'm a B-O-O-K worm. I like to read and I like to write, and I wear glasses to improve my sight. Chemistry, math, and reading too. They're all fun subjects for me and you. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm, bookworm. I'm a B-O-O-K worm. Don't be
is not a crime. Take a minute to listen to this rhyme.
I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm, bookworm. I'm a B-O-O-K worm. Everybody, don't be afraid to be a bookworm. Raise your hand if you're a bookworm. Raise it high in the air. I'm a B-O-O-K worm. I'm a bookworm. I'm a bookworm.
Coming up, Jane's Rains interviews Allison Williford in Beyond the Cover.
Today on our show, Dog-Eared Reads, we are privileged to have Allison Williford, who is a romance and women's fiction author, blogger, and all-around nerd. She is the owner and operator of The Sentenced Writer, a blog dedicated to helping other writers. She's originally from upstate New York, and now she lives in coastal North Carolina with her husband and her dog, Wilson. In addition to writing, Allison is a mental illness awareness and suicide prevention advocate, and she has written her first book, Waiting for You, A Story of Loss, Grief, and Love, which is now available on Amazon. Allison, thank you for being on our show.
Yeah, great to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
So could you tell us a little bit about your background?
I was a pretty normal kid, grew up in upstate New York, had a sister growing up. I was that fairly stereotypical nerdy kid who read all day, every day,
okay.
And then most of my time at the library, I was that kid. But otherwise, I had a fairly normal childhood growing up.
When did you decide to become a writer?
I'd have to say it was in seventh grade. It was Mr. Madison's English class. He ran a publication for the school, and it was all like short stories, fiction, and poetry. And I submitted something that ended up getting featured, and I just remember thinking, oh, that is so cool. And it just kind of grew steadily from there. So I've been writing for quite some time, but Waiting for You is my first work I've actually put out.
Okay. Why do you write?
I believe it was Harper Lee who said, any writer worth his salt writes to please himself.
Okay.
So that is pretty much it. It's just something I enjoy, and it's just that is the basic reason why I write. It's just I love to do it.
Where do you think your ideas come from?
I have to say they're a conglomeration of everything that ever goes on in my own head and
okay.
every event that has ever happened to me.
All right. Could you tell us a little bit about your book that you've just published?
Yep, it is a contemporary sweet romance, considered a clean and wholesome romance. There's nothing explicit in it.
Okay.
And it is the story of 23-year-old Kylie Lewis. Her mother is diagnosed with terminal breast cancer.
Okay.
And in the midst of trying to navigate this inevitable loss, she also has this budding relationship with Adam, and she's really just trying to navigate all of that going on at once and trying not to shut down.
And so what audience would this book be geared towards?
I'd say younger audiences, almost young adult, new adult, definitely women. It is definitely a women's book.
Okay.
And that's about it. That's probably my biggest audience is right around 17, 18-year-olds.
Okay. And so just hearing a little bit about the subject of your book, it seems like within the pages, it seems like there would be a lot of issues with mental health, really struggling with going through a loss of that nature. Would you say that that's one of the focuses of your book to talk about that?
Yeah, depression is definitely in there. And there's a character that in there, his name is Sean, and he is a nod to my own struggles with mental health and
okay.
addiction. And he's just that minor character. I couldn't resist putting somebody in who was a testament to my own sobriety, and
okay.
that is Sean. So, yes, there is some mental health in there.
Okay. What advice, as you mentioned kind of depression, and what advice would you give to somebody who's struggling in that area, as somebody who kind of writes about those things and has experience with those things?
Just no matter how awful it seems or feels at the time, even if you're just hanging on by a thread, keep hanging on. I've been through quite a bit with my own bipolar disorder, and I know how awful it can feel.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the actual writing process. Do you get to write full-time or do you write part-time?
I write part-time. I would love someday to be able to write full-time, but until then I do have a day job. But that's about it. I mean, I do most of my writing in the morning.
Okay.
So I do get up a little earlier so I can write before I kind of get my day started.
That makes total sense. A very famous author, Catherine Coulter, has told me or informed me in the past that, you know, most writers have a day job and have to get up really early to write. So when it comes to actual writing things down on paper, do you have an outline or plot, or do you just prefer to kind of take the idea and see where it goes?
That is probably the best description. I take an idea, see where it goes, until I have enough of an idea to come up with an outline. So I don't have that solid answer to, am I a pantser or a plotter?
Okay. I've never heard it that way, but that's an excellent way of saying it.
Yeah.
What do you think for you is the hardest thing about writing?
I have to say, pretty much sticking to my routine of getting up early and writing. I'm the kind of writer, if I don't write something every day, I fall out of the habit of it. And then it's just so hard to get back into the habit of writing. So that would probably be the hardest thing for me, is just staying in the habit of writing. I could talk a little bit about what I'm working on now.
That would be great.
See, my work in progress is a sequel to Waiting for You. It's titled Waiting for Life.
Okay.
And the main focus is mental health. It is very much about addiction and bipolar disorder. I originally wanted to write a memoir about my life with bipolar disorder and how I came to be a shock therapy patient.
Okay.
And that's been a huge part of my recovery, is shock therapy. And I tend to get a lot of varied reactions when people hear that I am a shock therapy patient. And that will be part of this next book. And a lot of things I've been through personally are being applied to this work in progress as fiction. So I'm pretty much just taking it piecemeal and applying it to this story. But I think this is going to be a lot heavier than Waiting for You. You know, Waiting for You, even though it deals with loss and grief, it's still fairly light as far as the theme goes. So Waiting for Life is definitely going to be a lot darker and a lot heavier as far as the theme.
Okay. And just because a lot of our viewers might have a negative or misunderstanding of what you would call therapy of that nature, could you explain a little bit about what that is and kind of how it's maybe misunderstood in current society?
Yeah, it's definitely one of the most stigmatized treatments for mental health issues. I came to be an ECT patient. The official name is electroconvulsive therapy.
Okay.
The process is they bring me in, they set up an IV, I get general anesthesia and a muscle relaxer. So I'm asleep during the entire treatment.
Okay.
And your body's not actually having a physical seizure like they used to in the old days, back when they were first starting with shock therapy treatments. It's no more like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Everybody always thinks of that.
Yeah.
So it's not like that. It's you're asleep. It just looks like you're asleep. There's actually a video on YouTube of a modern day ECT treatment, and it looks like you're asleep is all it really is. Came to be an ECT patient just after years of struggling with my bipolar disorder. I did survive a suicide attempt in 2008, and I was on and off a whole laundry list of medications that did fail. They didn't work for me. I even tried what are called transcranial magnetic stimulation treatments, which that's a mouthful, and those didn't work for me. I was in and out of the hospital. And finally, my doctor said, let's try it. Let's try ECT, see if it works. And I've been going for over 2 years now.
Okay.
And it has kept me stable. So it's really not the monster that people think it is.
Okay. Right, well, thank you for sharing that with us. I think you're right. I think there's such a stigma with that, because in all the movies and all the literature, it's always like a painful, unwanted, scary thing that occurs that looks almost medieval, because they're showing it, you know, the way it was done in kind of its infant stages, when there was some knowledge about what it could do, but not necessarily a good way of doing it.
Yeah. The biggest question I get is whether or not I lose my memory. And the answer is no, actually. That was probably the biggest concern I had when I was first started ECT treatments, was whether or not my memory was really going to be affected. And they commonly nowadays do what's called unilateral treatments, where the electrodes are on one side of the head.
Okay.
As opposed to the traditional old-timey ECT, where the electrodes are on both sides of the head.
Okay.
So no, I really don't have memory issues. Occasionally I forget a conversation I had maybe the other day, but that's about it. I think that's pretty much true for everybody.
Yeah, I do that all the time.
Yeah.
So as somebody who's both experienced this and who is kind of a professional in this field, what do you think are some of the biggest mental health challenges facing our current society?
I'd have to say a lot of people who are going through mental health issues, they're too scared to ask for help, I believe. At least that's how it was for me. It was just, I was so afraid of being judged for speaking up and saying, hey, I need help. And there's a campaign, I believe it's coming from Australia, that's geared towards men and getting men to speak up about their mental health. And the campaign is called It's Okay to Not Be Okay. And I think that's a really, really cool one. Just saying it's okay. It's okay to talk about it.
Oh, wow. Well, excellent. Definitely. Thank you for sharing your experiences and being open about those things. And it's just, it's mind-boggling to think, you know, of this big battle that's occurring all over the place within individuals. And, you know, one of the biggest challenges to that is a fear of getting help. So is there any other information that you would like to add that maybe you haven't included, maybe some information about where we can find your book?
Yep, my book is available on Amazon, and I also sell paperback copies through my own website, AllisonWilliford.com. And, of course, I also have my website, thesentrancedwriter.com, and I have links to all of that up there as well. I'm on Facebook and Twitter. Facebook is facebook.com/AllisonWilliford1, and my Twitter handle is ALLIW_Wright, so that's Allie W. Wrights, and that's my Twitter handle.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you for taking the time, Allison, to be on our show, and we appreciate all that you've been able to talk with us about.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, James. Want to know more about what's happening at the Kodiak Public Library? Follow KPLA on Facebook or visit our website at KodiakPublicLibraryAssociation.org, or pick up the schedule of library events available at your public library and online. Happy reading! You've been listening to Dog-Eared Reads, Kodiak Public Library Association's show for book lovers of all ages. Are you new to Kodiak or looking for a place to contribute your time? We are always looking for volunteers. There's opportunities for this radio show, as well as seasonal availabilities when you can offer your time on an ongoing basis. You can help with book sales, author events, and more. Visit us online at KodiakPublicLibraryAssociation.org or on Facebook at the same name. Hope to see or hear from you soon, and keep on reading.
Heaven in your breath, the simplest of pleasures, the world at its best.